where are we on Mel's career work?
Well,
hello?
Well, why don't you look over some of the publications, see if you would like to comment on either people, students, or the...
Vinyl carbonate, which is
yes,
very interesting.
Sure, there are many other ones, and I think Mel should be the one to tell us something that is not very well known by reading of the papers.
Have you got the tape back on? Yeah. While you're looking through that, Mel... one of the things that you might talk about is, I suppose it came out of the, I know it came out of the steric thing you did, but you were a great proponent at one time of trying to sell the idea of the rule of six. And maybe you want to say a few words about that and its utility, because, again, I think it's the kind of thing that... is sort of, in a way, characteristic of your work, having found a lot of interesting facts, trying to put them together in a way that's useful to other people, help in understanding and predict what they might get if they use these simple kinds of approaches to organic synthesis.
Well, your mention of the rule of six is interesting because it brings back to mine a lot of letters I had. And even telephone calls from people when this was first published. Now, the original publication, I had a statement in it that the rule of six is only of use when you want to make a rapid estimate of something. If the real way to find out whether steric effects will be important would be to take a set of models and make a set of models and look at it, and that would include not only the substance you were talking about, but also the reagent that you were using. And the rule of six came because we had the greatest number of relative rate constants for a number of aliphatic acids, one we had made and others. And I assembled them all in a paper. I think there were about 25 or 30 aliphatic acids whose rates had been measured. And if you do that... See, early in the steric effects, everybody was talking about alpha substitution. If you have substitution on the alpha carbon, that slows the rate down. But in this paper, I pointed out that beta substitution could be equally or even more important, depending on the group. And the way to estimate this was just to count the carbonyl oxygen as one, and then count around the chain. And the hydrogens in the sixth position... The more atoms there were in the sixth position, the more hindered the compound would be. I said, it was only a qualitative concept. But that when the sixth number began to be as high as 9 or 12, then you were in serious, serious trouble. Well, I had letters saying that this is a very poor rule, because how can you explain the fact that this acid and this acid, which have the same six number, have so much difference in the rate? My only answer was, this is qualitative, and the main point of it is, when you get 9 and 12, you're in trouble. And anything more than that, it's serious trouble. So it was only a qualitative concept to look at a formula and count when you don't have models. I haven't changed my opinion on that at all. It's useful, but anybody who tries to apply it quantitatively is just not using it properly. It was never meant as a quantitative. Although if you put numbers, some people are always going to try to do it quantitatively. But chemistry isn't that simple. The use of ketones has never been studied. See, acids have only one... chain can be branched on. But nobody's ever done a systematic study of ketones. For example, is it best to have all your branching on one side or on both sides? This is the kind of thing that could be done, but nobody's seen fit to do it.
Are you game to investigate ketones now? Or did you ever seriously consider to investigate this?
I never considered it because I thought... I didn't see the utility of it.
In other words, this was already, you proved a point, and this would be belaboring. Yes.
And so some people, you know, would make 15 or 20 yes. ketones and measure the rates. Yes. And I had other things that I thought were more important to do.
In other words, even under the condition of adverse reaction or criticism, outright criticism, you never felt strong enough about this point to justify
spending the time. I thought the more important things to do.
Yeah, well, this is, I think, almost typical of you. And
I think you can, if you look at some of the physical organic work that's published, the people who do it seem more interested in just getting straight lines than in deciding what good it is. I give you a perfect example of that. You know this Hammett Sigma Rho, which is a beautiful concept. But if you're trying to determine a rho for a thing, you can do it with three or four compounds. You don't need 12 compounds. If you do 12 compounds, they have these coefficients. It fits, you know, better. But so what? The rho doesn't change much. And what does the rho mean anyway?
Well, it sensitivity
means it's well, so. Whether a thing is 3.9 or 4.1, what is the difference?
You did some work on the Van 't Hoff I factors, and I believe you had a postdoctoral student, Bob Taft, who sort of went into a field and pursued it much further, sulfuric acid. How would you evaluate this particular aspect? Because he did come up with some additional information to be sure.
He had some useful stuff out of it. I can't say that I can remember now just what it was.
Neither do I, incidentally.
But he had a point, and it was useful. But it was not useful on highly hindered compounds. It was in the intermediate range. He never got to the highly hindered compounds. Well, it's probably important because the highly hindered compounds wouldn't react. So there's no point.
But you wouldn't think that he was belaboring this
problem. No, he had a different aspect.
Are there any other publications that you start looking through your publication that you would like to comment on? Yeah, why don't I hold this for you?
One little point is there's not many publications on it, but it's a question of monoalkylation of hydroquinone. Now, that etrohydroquinone has two OH groups in it. Suppose you want to make the monomethyl ether of it, which we wanted to do at one time, and another ether we wanted to make. I look up the literature on it, and I'm amazed to find out that nobody has a good preparation for the monomethyl ether. If you make the sodium salt, sodium hydroxide, methyl iodide, you get as much dimethyl as you do mono.
Even
with one mole, because the answer is once you've got methoxy,
the
other one can do it. And so as you start building up concentration of mono, you get di, and so you reach a point where you're destroying it as fast as you're building it. So nobody had a good preparation of it. Well, I thought about it and I said, here's an example where Hauser's principle of Diana ought to be brought in. Now, nobody had ever done it. You know Hauser's Diana ions. He showed that you could make a second ion on anything that would make a mono ion if you treated it with a strong enough thing. And so if you take hydroquinone and just add two equivalents of sodium hydroxide, now you've got a bis anion. And the bis anions are always more reactive than the mono. So he took various.
More reactive than the first substitution,
right,
yes.
Because it's a much stronger base.
Yes.
And so he did this. It turned out that the physical characteristics had something to do with it, the solubilities.
Mm-hmm.
But when you allow for that, you could get fine yields of monoalkylation products with a variety of things.
So using two equivalents rather than one equivalent.
Right. Yeah. Now that's perfectly simple, and yet it hadn't been done.
Professor Newman is referring to a paper with James Cella, C-E-L-L-A, published in General Organic Chemistry 39, 214,
1974. Now, 1970, you see, is fairly well along in science. And up to that date, there was no decent method of making the monomer. Isn't that almost unbelievable?
In the same line of thought, the same problem exists if you try to esterify a dibasic acid. Would you recommend going through the dianion instead of esterification using alkyl halide and the sole?
It depends how close the ions are to each other, because you get in complications with a disalt of an acid in a cyclization type thing.
Well, say adipic acid and longer.
Apart,
yes.
And one has no influence on the other. So, okay.
So that's
offhand, it doesn't look as good.
Well, but still, in any dibasic acid, there is a 10 times a fourth or fifth power difference between the ionization constant of the mono and ion. Or is it true only in the lower ones? Well, this is great difference.
I don't know how it works out with the higher ones. Mm-hmm. But the principle is there, whether it will apply or not, it wouldn't take very long to find out.
But this paper we just were looking over, is this a PhD thesis or just
That's
a tangential sort of thing? I mean, in other words...
It was done during a PhD. He had also...
But this was not the main subject.
Not the only one, no.
Yes.
And it didn't take him long to do it. Mm-hmm. And, for example, he could get... Well, the first experiment... he did. He got a 62% yield of the monomethoxy, which is way and above anybody else had ever done it. Now, he only did one experiment with methyl iodide, but he had things... We were more interested in bromoesters for a certain reason, and he found out he could get quite good yields of monoalkylation product by using this principle.
You publish mostly in General American Chemical Society Journal and Journal of Organic Chemistry. Did you ever have any papers that were rejected by the referees, which eventually were published in some other and turned out to be some outstanding contributions?
No.
In other words, no problem with referees over the years?
Oh, I've had problems with referees, but they usually get worked out.
Who did most of the writing of papers based on dissertation?
I've written all.
You have written all of them?
All of the papers. The reason is this. I usually go through quite a job trying to get a good thesis written. And it takes really, very often, drives me to the limit of my patience. Then when it comes to writing a paper on the work, I just arbitrarily decided I was going to write. I wasn't going through the same thing again. I said, a student, if he goes and does anything else, any place else, he should write the papers. But for the while it was fresh in my mind, I want to get it done.
And are there any dissertations that never found their way into print? I mean,
I think a few. Almost... Without exception, there's been at least one publication, and every person has got a PhD. And I think I've had something like maybe 120 PhDs. I don't think there are as many as five in which there was no publication.
You had 120 students that got a doctorate. How about master students?
40.
Of course, some may have gone on and...
Some of them got...
Yes. But how many students altogether got a degree from you, one or more degree from you?
Well, that would add up to about 150.
No, because I thought some of the master students are the same ones that got a doctorate. So I thought perhaps there may be fewer ones.
I've got up roughly 40 masters and 110 PhDs. That's 150 in all. There's some duplication.
Yes, that's what I mean.
But I would say roughly not so many. Most of the people that got MSs with me didn't get PhDs.
Oh, I see.
They may have gone someplace.
Well, I'd say 150 students. But obviously there were many more students that started work but never finished. How many would be in this category that started and changed for one reason or another, death or military service?
I've given some very good advice, which they thanked me for later.
Changing.
Advice was something like this. They were working. They start out working for a master's degree. And after a certain period of time, I would evaluate them. And it all depended upon the current situation with regard to jobs, too. It was not an absolute evaluation. But when jobs were scarce, I would say to myself, here's a person that I never can recommend as being outstanding. Mm-hmm. If he spends 2-3 years more and gets a PhD degree, he's going to have a hell of a time getting a job. I'm going to advise him to stop now and tell him this frankly, which I did, just face to face, exactly what I'm telling you. And they would be a little bit miffed or something, but after a day or two, we'd talk it over again. Well, what advice would you give? Well, the advice I gave was to look into business administration and law. If you go into these areas, that plus your chemistry will make you a valuable person. And quite a few of these people did that and wrote letters afterwards saying that they had wonderful jobs and thanked me for the advice. Now, their jobs were as lawyers or as business administrators in chemical firms.
Well, then still, the question that I raised earlier, how many students worked with you at one time, not counting postdoctoral, that's going to be a separate question. 140 or 50 got a degree, so that's 140 students. And how many started out and dropped?
Maybe 20 or 30.
Not very many. I think your record is far superior to anything that I know of, because we always have so many students that start and just disappear, evaporate. They sign up but never do any work. How many postdoctoral students associated with you?
I think roughly 100.
100 postdoctoral?
Yeah.
Would you be able to identify the source of postdoctoral students? Was there some kind of a pipeline?
I have a list at the lab.
Yes.
Where the funds for most of them are written on the cards.
Yes. I hope to get this, but this can be mailed in if I won't have a chance. But was there any particular school or individual more than anybody else who was sending postdoctoral students to you? Can you identify, or is there no trend?
No.
Well, how did postdoctoral students reach you? Recognition?
Write a letter.
I know, but usually it's by recommendation of somebody.
Mm-hmm.
Said I'm writing to you at the recommendation of Professor so-and-so.
Yeah, but what I'm saying is I can't remember any one particular person sending a series of students. It was always a large, different bunch.
Which means you were widely recognized for your contribution, and this obviously must have influenced people, and they made a recommendation. How many foreign students did you have over the years? Do you have any idea? Approximately.
I'd have to look over the list, but I would say of late years, I've had a large group of Indians.
Mm-hmm.
They started some years ago, and I had such excellent people from certain places in India that they kept on recommending very good students.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the Indian postdocs that I've had were characterized by being excellent lab workers and very hard workers. They had very little originality. Very few of the Indians that I've had really go into the chemistry. They want to do the work, but they haven't originated ideas. Now, there have been a few exceptions.
But Indians mostly interested in natural products or chemistry.
They're interested in a job and coming to this country for a while.
Yeah.
A lot of them want to stay here.
Yeah.
And you can understand that when you hear what they would go back to in India.
It's a phone name, Swami something,
Swami
from Madras, yes.
He
spent his sabbatical.
Pandya,
he's a very well,
well
he's
known.
A senior professor at Madras, if
yes.
I remember correctly.
Mm-hmm.
And was he sending students, his own?
He sent some.
Mm-hmm.
Not a great number, but some. This fellow George I mentioned, he's also a professor. I have to look up his name.
How were the foreign students prepared psychologically as well as professionally in comparison to American students?
I had two Germans, one from Wittig and one from Wiskin, in the same year. Extremely highly recommended, both of them. And I was very disappointed in both of them in the sense that they didn't seem to have much originality. Technically, they were expert.
And these were doctoral students, postdoctoral
people
students?
People who had PhDs
mm-hmm.
there,
yes.
who wanted to come to this country, but they would more or less, you know, what should I do?
Well, was this because they did not know, or was it because of a false sense of modesty, giving the professor the first refusal or first right to suggest something?
I don't know. Each of them stayed for only 1 year.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know. I put it down to the fact that each of these people had very large numbers of people working there.
Yeah.
And I think they more or less organized their work. Wiskin had something like 40 people working with him. Now, how can a person take care of 40 people unless he more or less, he doesn't have time to sit down and talk with each one for any length of time.
Well, this sounds to be a little bit contradictory. If he didn't have time, then the student would have more chance to show his initiative.
But on the other hand, he could be the type that more or less wrote out what he wanted this guy to do and what he wanted mm-hmm. this guy to do, which I think is the way he's going to operate.
Well, because the relationship of student to professor in Europe, in particular, it's different,
right.
quite different. It has been changing in recent years, but the professor is still God Almighty, and when he says something, it goes. And
Wiskin, at one time, you see, he had almost all 40 people working on the same project, the same type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I just don't agree that this is the best way to operate. I think Wittig may have done a lot of the same thing. You know, when he was working on carbines, all these people were working on carbines instead of just some.
Well, these you mentioned two German postdoctoral students. How about...
I had a number of English.
That's what I was leading up to. How do they compare?
Well,
or did compare?
They both developed beautifully. Well, two of them, Eglinton, who's a prof now at Bristol, and Ian Scott, who's now in Texas. He's been all over the world. He was in Canada at Yale, and now he's at some place in Texas. And Ian Scott is probably the one with the biggest reputation. He's done some magnificent work.
Yeah, I forgot that Jeff Eglinton was a postdoc, was he?
Sure. Eglinton and Scott both came from the same place, from Glasgow.
This Sir Jones.
No,
Jones. E.R.H. Jones.
No, he was not at Glasgow. Rayfield and Barton. But these people were from...
No, from Manchester. I think Jones is a student. When Jones was still at Manchester, and then he went to Oxford.
I'm trying to think. Who was the prophet at Glasgow when Eglinton came over? The person just before Barton, whoever that was.
I don't recall.
J.W. Cook.
No.
How about Oriental students? What was your experience with Oriental students?
Well, I've had some Taiwanese.
Did they have any language barrier?
Not in particular, no. They were no problems.
They received their degree in proportion.
One interesting thing, a fellow named Bill Hung, who got his PhD at the University of Massachusetts and came to work with me, and he had a terrific stuttering problem. If you wanted to talk with him, you know, I just have to wait until he'd get the words out. So after, before very long, I said, well, you ought to try and see if you can have something done about the study. To make a long story short, he went to the English department where they had some specialists on this, and he took some treatment there for about 6 months, and it improved him terrifically. And so he could, you know, carry on a conversation.
Well,
okay. He was an outstanding chemist, but his language was just terrible.
It was a Korean, Hung is that name probably. No, Chinese.
Hung is, I think he's Taiwan.
Any Japanese students?
Yeah.
How about their background?
Two or three.
East Europeans?
I had one Hungarian. He never took a bath. He didn't want to walk in the same lab with him. I think he lived in a house where 24 people lived. He said some horror stories that you hear what he went through.
And he's back in Hungary?
Yeah.
Did he come here under some kind of official exchange agreement between the academy? Through the Academy of Sciences?
He just wrote for a postdoctoral fellowship, and I'd never had anybody from there before, so he's had good recommendations. He was a good chemist.
And do you know in what capacity he's back in Hungary?
No, I haven't heard from him since he's back. It was not too, his English wasn't very good. And as I say, I wouldn't dare come close to anybody.
Well, maybe some chemicals he worked with.
Oh, I doubt it.
We are running out of the state here, and although I hope this is not the end of it, I just want to be sure that we repeat something, a question that I asked earlier on tape number one, which may have been accidentally erased, namely, are there any limitation of the information that has been recorded here that you impose on this? Any limitation, reservation, anything like that?
No limitation.
I just want to be quite sure that this is understood, because it may be out of our control if we're going to put in a depository, in an archive, or anything like that. That question may be brought up by other people, and I just want to be sure that they know this is information that can be used in any publication or any scholarly work that deals with history of chemistry, organic chemistry in particular, at Ohio State University, and Mel Newman in particular.
No restrictions.
How about you've been awfully silent. Well, shall we turn it off for a moment?
Here, above the plane, the others have to be in the plane. The same way the carbonium ion is also true. The vacant orbitals are not in the same plane where these electrons are. And, there's a lot of chemistry that you can get some useful things. And then we have a few more papers in which this intermediate could react with a bunch of different things. And, for example, if they react with a silane, you can get an unsaturated.
How about the parent compound with the violine, carbene, sort of?
Oh, that's too much. You can't do that. Explosive. If you do this thing with ethanolamine, the thing explodes.
Just react to the cell.
I had made the nitrosa compound myself with this thing. Well, that was CH2. It was a nice yellow solid.
Yeah.
I put it in a vac desiccator to dry.
Yeah.
First thing you know, I heard the top of the desiccator rattling. I went and grabbed it and did that, and I shot out of the scanner.
No damage to you. Something I wanted to ask, and I want to be sure that I do ask. How's your health these days?
Well, the last week it's been lousy. I've got a cold from these kids. But other than that, it's been fine.
I don't understand. You had a call from these kids.
The kids came with a cold.
Oh, I see.
Apart from them.
Yes. But there are no ill effects from the accident that you had in 1978?
I lost my hearing in my right ear completely, and that's upset my sense of balance.
Yes.
I still feel sort of dizzy when I walk. And you know, sometimes when you stumble, you almost fall?
Yes.
Well, I have to watch it when I walk.
No, the question is, you lost your equilibrium because damage in the inner ear, probably,
right.
Which is one. But was this a result of the accident, or was this the cause of your fall? Because it could have very well been, you know, since you
No, it
fell.
Was a result.
It's a result, definitely.
Because all the examination the doctors made, they couldn't find anything the matter with me except that I had a concussion.
Yes.
And what we talked about it, we concluded that, see, I was taking a rest after lunch in my office when this happened. And lying down on easy chair, next thing I know, I wake up, I'm in the hospital. He says what probably happened is the telephone rang, and I got up all of a sudden, and a rush of blood from my head caused me to lose consciousness. And I fell and struck my head.
I heard on television this week that some people, when they get up suddenly, lose their equilibrium.
Black out.
But yes, when they suddenly get up, and they know they have to get up very, very slowly. Mm-hmm. So the question was whether you already had the damage in the inner ear.
No, before that I had nothing.
Well, that you may not have been really aware of.
Well, let's say it wasn't evident.
Evident, that's what I wanted, because in the same line of thought, there are people who fall and break their hip, but actually they broke their hip and they fell down afterwards, because their bone become fragile.
The doctor couldn't say for sure how this happened, because nobody saw it. All they know, they saw me lying on the floor then.
Yes. But other than that, you look certainly in good health. You're tanned, you're vigorous and energetic.
You know, in golf, I've lost my sense of distance. My putting is just atrocious. Everything else is all right. Putting is awful.
Well, that's a lasting effect.
The doctor says it might...
you just have to get holes in one, and I'll say,
that's right. I tell you a wonderful joke about you telling this dentist thing.
Yeah.
This is called my son, who's a motorcycle enthusiast. It seems as this guy went to Japan on a trip and prided himself on his farting.
In Japan, that's a great sport.
And in Japan, he gets there, lets out a big fart, and it says, Honda! So, geez, he never done anything like that before, so he said, I better wait. It's a strange country. The next day, another fart comes out. Honda! So he goes to the doctor. The doctor examines him all of us. He says, yes, he come here on the chair. I know just what the trouble is. He picks out an abscess tooth, see? And the guy says, how can that have anything to do?